So I would like on behalf of the Sangha to repeat the welcome, warm welcome to Venerable Tithapaño during the course of the ceremony. I was reminded of some words of Ajahn Chah when he was asked whether his intimate knowledge of his disciples' personalities and dispositions was due to his psychic powers. And he would usually brush off questions about psychic powers anyway. But in this particular case, he said, "It's not necessary. I just seeing how somebody walks into the sala, how they carry a spittoon, how they sit down, how they put out their sitting cloth. All these indications are enough for me to form a very good idea of the disposition of my disciples." So, hearing Venerable Tithapaño's very clear, unwavering, well-pronounced Pali in what is quite an intimidating situation, in the midst of the Bhikkhu Sangha with large number of family and friends sitting behind, I think is a very good indicator of a firm and solid disposition and someone who will do well in the Bhikkhu Sangha. Certainly we all hope that will be the case. I think that most of you, many of you will know that the Bhikkhu Sangha probably the oldest functioning institution of any kind in the world. And it is an institution defined primarily by the vinaya, by the trainings, the training rules of the monk. It's what essentially distinguishes the bhikkhu from the lay Buddhist. The lay Buddhists all hopefully practice meditation and are interested in abandoning unwholesome dhammas, developing wholesome dhammas, purifying their mind. But the Buddha made it clear that the surroundings, the conditions within which we practice are very important. And the essence of the vinaya is the creation of the optimum conditions for the practice of Dhamma. Indeed, the word vinaya is not restricted to its meaning of the that we're most familiar with, the monastic code, but there is a lay vinaya as well, and it means trying the best one can to create the conditions that most are most conducive to practice of Dhamma. Some people say, "Do you really need to become a monk to practice Buddha's teachings sincerely or to benefit from them in a profound way?" And the answer is definitely no. But at the same time, it's clear that if it was sufficient for practice to live as a lay person, the Buddha wouldn't have created the Sangha. So the Sangha is not a sort of a caste apart, but one who enters the Sangha is one who, in Ajahn Chah's words, is ready to put his life on the line. So it's entering the Sangha is a signal of a greater commitment and being willing to relinquish many of the both responsibilities and enjoyments and pleasures of the lay life, and to focus one's life wholly without compromise on the Buddhist path. And it is through the fact that men and women have been entering the Buddhist monastic order for 2,500 years that the Buddhist teachings are still thriving. And we all have the opportunity to practice them today. If we look, study Buddhist history, even at a superficial level, we can see a very clear correlation between the well-being of the Buddha Sasana and the well-being of the Buddha Sangha. Wherever the Sangha thrives, the Buddha Sasana thrives. Wherever the Sangha declines, the Buddha Sasana declines. And entering the Buddhist monastic order is, I think, the most wonderful thing. Even in the very early days, when one is still struggling to learn and to adapt to the life, the opportunity to live in a community of like-minded people, all with the same goals, all trying to help each other to grow in what is good and noble, is such a singular, unique opportunity. To live in a community where you don't even have the slightest fear that someone will hit you, strike you, lie to you, steal from you, where the highest standards of morality are every day. They're not even spoken about. They're the lowest sort of common denominator, and something that we take for granted in a way. In the early days of practice as a monk, then even though it's noticed some of the monks here have names of some of the great disciples of the Buddha, but we can often feel that we're a long way away from the practice of the monks in the Buddha's time. But I think there is one way that from the very first day as a bhikkhu we can feel a real intimacy with the Buddha himself and with the great summoners of the past, both in the Buddha's time, throughout the centuries since the Buddha passed away. And that is perhaps surprisingly in keeping the rules of discipline. For instance, you saw the swapping around of robes before the ceremony began. And it's very important for a monk that he has the right sanghati, this robe, because there's a rule that at dawn you have to have all three robes within arm's length. And so when you check to make sure at dawn that you've got all three robes, you're actually practicing, you're doing something that's kind of strange, and it's not obviously connected with the moral life or sort of ethical education, but you're doing something that was laid down specifically by the historical Buddha. If Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Moggallana, Venerable Chunda, Venerable Mahakasapa, all these monks were to come and see what we were doing just now, or to watch the ceremony, they would have instantly known what was going on, that they would have participated in such ceremonies many, many times. We act, we behave, we conduct ourselves within boundaries which were laid down by the Buddha himself. So simply living the life of a monk very quietly and humbly is living within a code, within a form which was laid down by the Buddha. Just the thought of that as a monk is a thrilling thought, literally a thrilling thought, that we are connected in that way with some of the greatest beings that have ever lived. I mean, it's my conviction that maybe 95% of the enlightened beings of the arahants of the world have been members of this institution, and for that reason alone, it's an institution worthy of great veneration. But to be a part of that, to participate in it, and to serve to extend its life, is I think a wonderful thing. In Thailand, you may think that parents and family are very proud and happy when their sons and relatives become monks. And often that is the case, but there's a big if, you know, as long as they don't stay as monks for very long. People like this. So I've sometimes have mothers come to me and sort of complaining that their sons won't disrobe, that they ordained and they were supposed to come out after a month and get rich and get married, and that they won't do it anymore. So I have these words of comfort and consolation for mothers, and I say, you know, right now you're the number one woman in your son's life. You're the most important woman in his whole life. Now, if he was to disrobe and get married, his wife would start to take a lot of his attention. And if he got and he had children, he'd have daughters, and your status as number one is going to slip. As long as your son stays as a monk, you're going to be his number one. And this is a very successful way I've found of teaching. And I've kept a number of monks in the row, I think, through. Excuse me with all this. This sound. So the I think one of the values of I'm not going to speak very long this evening, but just wanted to say that sometimes you hear these sort of hypothetical questions. You know, what would you do if you found that you only had one more week to live or one more day to live? You know, you think, well, I do this and I do that, but for a Buddhist monk, you know, the answer to this is what in Pali would be called amatakang amatalungang, which would translate as a no-brainer. It's my own translation. A Pali joke for the monks. But the question is, I'd be doing exactly what I'm doing right now. And I think every one of us would say, yeah, you know, If the world was going to end in tomorrow, what would you want to just be doing exactly what we're doing right now? And that is a great gift. So whether or not all of us or any of us become arahants in this life, just the sense that we're within a vessel that was designed by the Buddha and which has provided the foundation for the realization of the highest spiritual attainments by a huge number of people over the centuries, and to be able to take part in this, to participate in it, and as one gets older, to share one's knowledge and experience with others, I think is marvelous. And before I became a monk, a big question for me is, what's the right way to live? What's the good way to live? What's the best way to live? And the short answer I gave is living in such a way which is for my own benefit and happiness and for the benefit and happiness of others. And when I found the form of the bhikkhu, this seemed to me quite obviously, yes. Living as a bhikkhu is a way in which I can truly discover happiness and benefit for myself and to create that for others. I'm very happy to have the opportunity to come here. I didn't know that there was going to be an Upasampada ceremony before I came. Last time I came in the year 2000, the same thing happened. And I think in Thailand, many forest monks ordain in local monasteries with an upajaya who they rarely see again after the ordination. And so Titipaniyu, I mean, the monks here, especially fortunate in that their upajaya is their teacher. And they don't have just one wonderful teacher, they have two. They have both Ajahn Pasno and Ajahn Amaro. So Titipaniyu, to be able to ordain in this monastery, the abbot as an upajaya, with Ajahn Amaro here also, and a number of senior monks and terers, means that this is a monastic community which is definitely thriving. And coming, you, many of you come here often, and for those of you who live here, you know, obviously you get used to it, and it's just what you know. But coming from Thailand, it is refreshing and inspiring, and I like to express my appreciation for the Sangha here and for all of you, and may Venerable Thitipanyo in particular grow in Sila and Samadhi and Panya, realize the fruit of the holy life. So I would like to end my discourse at this point.
Andamayam dhammakata sadhukaram dadamase
sadhu.